Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. It's such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for joining. And I am so excited for today's show because we have a live in-studio guest. I don't often get this privilege, but we've got it today. And it's really a double privilege because we have a very awesome and special guest, also a friend of mine, novelist Ed Park, is here. He's going to be speaking about his new book, An Oral History of Atlantis. Are you there with us, Ed?
I'm right here, Mark.
Oh, you're right there.
Yeah. And I see hello.
You.
Hello.
You are here. I see you right across the table.
It's great to be here, live in the studio.
It's so nice to have you on the show. I've been looking forward to this show. And so thank you for coming in. And I wanted to also say to the listeners, by way of introduction, that you, Ed, are officially a friend of the show. This is now your third appearance on Tectonic.
And that's right.
I'm pleased to present you with the traditional green jacket.
Thank you very much. fits perfectly.
First, you were on the show July 20, 2020. So this is right in the depths of COVID lockdown. Mm-hmm. You were talking of, obviously, we were not physically in the same space. We had to do a remote interview. But we were talking about reading during a pandemic, which was very, very apt for that moment.
Definitely.
July 2020. And if people are interested in what they should read during a pandemic, even though it's maybe not as timely at the moment, but there are book recommendations that you gave during that show.
Yeah.
And they're still posted on the playlist. And people can get to this if they go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the July 20, 2020 episode with Ed Park and click the playlist link. There's a bunch of books and graphic novels, if I remember right, that you recommended, Ed. And then about 3 years later, November 13, 2023, you were on Tectonic talking about your new, at the time, novel, which was called Same Bed, Different Dreams, a book I really enjoyed. And also at tectonic.fm, people can go back and listen to our interview talking about the themes and resonances that came out of that novel and the tie-in to our themes on Tectonic around technology that you wove so expertly through that narrative. So this is your third visit. But before we get to An Oral History of Atlantis, whatever happened to Same Bed, Different Dreams?
How do you mean?
Well, did you get any award nominations?
Oh, that's what you're asking. Well, yeah, so it came out. People seemed to like it, good reviews, and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer. It won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, which was great. I actually flew out to LA for the ceremony, but they didn't tell you if you won or not. So I was just kind of sitting there. They called my name, which is great.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It actually just won another award this summer, but they failed to invite me to. It was in Philadelphia, but it was the Asian Pacific American Literary Award, was also nice to get.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That must be gratifying. This book came out in 2023, and here we are a couple years later, and it's still bringing
it's
in
still
the awards.
Yes. Nice work if you can get it. Just write one book and have it sort of accumulate things.
Well, and, you know, correlation does not equal causation, I'll acknowledge. But we do have to point out that all of those nominations and wins came after the Tectonic appearance.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was a crucial interview. No, but it was truly one of my favorite interviews.
Well,
it was
thank
great.
You. Yeah. Well, I loved that book. And one of the key phrases that has stuck with me from reading Same Bed, Different Dreams is this phrase we talked about in the interview, which was, nothing is lost, everything connects.
Yes.
And that was resonant to me thinking about technology and the reality of networks and the companies and the platforms and all of the connections that we cover on the show. But specifically within Same Bed, Different Dreams, there were many connections between the storylines and characters. You're jumping forward and backward in time. And I was pleased to see that there was something of the same feel in this new book. And the new book is called An Oral History of Atlantis, Stories.
Sure. Yeah. It's a story collection.
It's a short story collection. I don't know. What is the right... Do you say stories at the end of
You don't have
time?
To say stories. I don't know. I mean, I guess on the spine, it doesn't say stories. So just say An Oral History of Atlantis. But I think just so people know that they're getting into a collection rather than a novel. Though I will say, I wouldn't say this book is a novel in stories. You know, something like Jennifer Egan's amazing Visit from the Goon Squad is maybe the most kind of a recent example of...
And she's another past Tectonic
She
guest.
Is, yes. I've listened to those. Yeah. But the interesting thing about this book is there are kind of these subtle connections between the stories. Some of the characters will pop up in different stories.
Exactly.
And we can talk about this later, but a couple of them also pop up in Same Bed, Different Dreams. So it kind of expands outward.
It's the Ed Park universe.
Of
course. It's the Ed Park cinematic universe.
That's right.
There's this one character, Hannah Hahn,
yes,
who you introduce early in An Oral History, and then later someone mentions Hannah just by her first name, and I wrote in my annotation, because I'm always writing in the margins, is that Hannah Hahn from page whatever. 36? Uh-huh. And it turns out it was. And so I bring that up just as an example of the experience of reading this book and being delighted to find that these independent, you know, standalone stories still have those connections.
Yeah.
Nothing is lost. Everything is connected.
That's right. To quote the other book. Yeah.
And these stories you wrote across a range of time, right?
Yeah. The very first story in the book is called A Note to My Translator. I was very young. I was about 27 when I wrote it. And it was published the following year, 1998. And
wow.
And it's still, like, I always liked that story, but it hasn't been widely available. It appeared in an anthology for a publisher that no longer exists, and it's not online anywhere, right? And so I thought, well, I wonder if it holds up. I wonder if this should be in the book. And I got as much pleasure out of it now as I did then. So that was the first one. And then there were kind of a cluster of stories in 2001, 2002, 2003. And, you know, I write stories kind of all the time in between working on novels, right? But there seems to have been like periods where I was particularly productive. So once we get into like the mid 2010s, there are a bunch of them. And I think the most recent story in here was probably written about 2021, 2022 and published, I believe, late 2023 or something.
And so
or 2024, I'm not sure.
These have appeared in a variety of places. You
yes.
mentioned the first story, A Note to My Translator, that the publisher no longer exists.
Yes.
But there are other still existing places like The New Yorker and McSweeney's.
That's
and Pioneer
right.
Works.
So you
have, what I find impressive is that you're writing from 98 into the 2020s. You're publishing these in a number of different magazines and journals, and there are several that are brand new.
Yeah, there are a couple that are not, that have not been published
never
before,
been published before. But even through that diversity of time and space, you're still managing to knit together some of these storylines.
Yeah, well,
was that the plan from the beginning?
That wasn't really the plan, although at a certain point I did know that An Oral History of Atlantis would be the title of my collection should I ever be so lucky to publish one. And, you know, the title story, An Oral History of Atlantis, I wrote in the summer of 2001.
Oh, wow.
And I immediately felt like this was a new kind of writing that, I was writing in a somewhat different style that appealed to me, like that felt generative, as they say, and a bit surreal. It takes place in a kind of an alternate Manhattan that has been sort of destroyed and decimated, actually, by a virus, right? So, you know, speaking of COVID much later, like
I didn't realize that was originally in 2001.
Because
I thought, oh, this is his pandemic reference.
This is not a pandemic reference. And I mean, eerily, obviously, like I wrote it for a reading for a journal that no longer exists. But it was kind of this magical reading. It was at a place in Brooklyn that no longer exists. And it was about kind of Manhattan being destroyed. And then, you know, a couple months later, 9/11 happens,
right?
Oh, right. And there's actually another story in here called with a very long title that's also kind of in that summer of 2001.
Yeah.
Like, on the one hand, it doesn't mean anything. But in retrospect, like, it just seems like, I don't know, paying tribute to a past version of the city, a past version of myself, a past version of literary culture, you know, speaking of like the journals that are no longer around, the venues that are no longer around. So it kind of, the story has kind of become this time capsule.
It's funny because the past,
yeah,
I felt was one of the dominant themes of many of the stories.
Yes.
And I want to dig into that, but just on that final story, Oral History of Atlantis, this fantastical story of Manhattan, it's destroyed, but it's also it's physically isolated,
right.
And you have this narrator who, it almost reads to me like a fable or a folk tale. It's magical in some ways. And the book that it reminds me of is The Tin Drum.
Yes.
And that was Günter Grass.
That's right.
Of course, writing his own magical version of a period of German history.
It's so funny you say that, because in the version that's in the book, there is no mention of the Tin Drum, but in the original version, which I published, I think it came out late 2002, there is this kind of like jokey reference to the narrator of my story is quite short, right? And he's kind of alluding to, it's a dwarf, right, who narrates the Tin Drum and sort of that, saying, yeah, exactly. I took it out for this version. Because I mean, it actually amused me a lot, but it felt I also felt like nobody knows about the Tin Drum anymore except you, which is very impressive. I should have put it back in. Yeah.
Well,
good call though.
Thank you.
Good connection.
Well, let's talk about the past.
Yeah.
Because you have a number of stories here where a character asks someone, "What was it like way back when?" Or you have an epistolary account. Dear so-and-so, let me tell you what it was like back then. And I can think of two stories, there may be others, but two stories off the bat that are from, they're telling stories from the 1990s.
Yeah.
And that's when you and I, it was around our college years or young adult, just starting out years. You've got one set at Yale, which is where you went to college.
That's right.
And you've got one set on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and both of us started out early on in Manhattan, and it was I felt a really interesting experience to get your fictional take on college years and Manhattan years in the 1990s. It felt very genuine.
Yeah, there's definitely a nostalgia factor, but one of the good things about being a writer who is, I was writing in my 20s, writing in my 30s, writing in my 40s, I'm writing in my 50s. There's something about, one of the few benefits, I think, about getting older and I guess, you know, being a writer, being an artist, is you kind of get that double vision, right? Because you remember things about that time, but you also can kind of frame it in the now. So Machine City, which is the story that it takes place kind of in the present, but it's looking the narrator is kind of looking back at an experience he had in college where he was kind of brought in to act in a student film. That actually, you know, this is not a big shocker. I am not an actor, but I was in a student film, and And I hadn't thought about it for years. And you can't find it online. It's just, but then one day I was like, I think I looked in the mirror or something. I looked funny. I looked a little different. And it almost was like I was in a, you know, I was a character in a play or in a movie. And I was like, oh yeah, wait, I was in a movie. And then suddenly all these like very particular specific memories came up. And, you know, most of the story is fiction, but to have those details at hand was really interesting. And then I kind of had to think about who is this narrator who's kind of in a job that he doesn't like and kind of reminiscing about, like, I don't know if they were the glory days, but there was a time in his life where he was more interesting, more artistic or something that I could not have written this story, you know, 3, 5, even 10 years after I graduated. It took a while.
Yeah. And the narrator, if I remember right, says that his name is Ed.
Does he really?
Yes.
He does indeed. Yes. Yeah.
That's very...
Unlike me, I think he's a lawyer or something, so...
Okay.
I missed
so
my
it,
calling.
It wasn't... It was a lightly fictionalized
yeah,
version.
That's right.
Very Proustian of you, Ed.
That's right.
Yeah. Lightly fictionalized autofiction. So in Machine City, I'm glad you brought up that story because... One of the passages I really liked, having to do with nostalgia, looking back, and technology, is near the beginning of the story. And if it's all right, I'll read a little bit. The internet barely existed when I was in college. Email was an impractical novelty. You'd send someone a message, and weeks might pass before they saw it. The message invariably ran something like, "Hey, just saying hello on this crazy machine. Have a nice day." You could only check email at a handful of terminals sprinkled around campus. No one had a modem back then, and the phones had coiled cords.
Yeah. Don't you miss those days?
I do. Yeah. I do. That's one of the themes of the show, I think, yeah. Is that the internet in those days was so much more innocent and less... bad in every way. I mean, there were bad things going on, but there's something charming about sending someone a message and just saying something like, "Hey, just saying hello." Yeah. And you could, it was the same where I went to college. Uh-huh. You could only check email at a handful of terminals. Nobody had computers in their room. You had to go to the Athena cluster to check your email.
To check it out, yeah.
And phones had coiled cords.
Right. Yeah.
And if I may, about phones with coiled cords, the bandwidth was just overflowing. The audio fidelity of your phone calls was a million times better than
it
what
was.
We get. Because it was a dedicated
was.
Line.
Yeah.
And it would come in through the coiled cord, which would allow you to walk around the dorm room or the
pace,
apartment
yeah.
and pace.
Exactly.
But not too far
not
because
too far.
The base station was there. I don't know. There's just your descriptions. This isn't the only one, but your descriptions and some of these stories about the early days of the internet, it made me wonder if you were, what brought that about that you kept returning to this feel of nostalgia for 90s internet culture in
yeah.
these stories?
Well, I might be a little older than you even, because we didn't have, I mean, there was sort of a little bit of email by my senior year, but, you know, I had a Mac in my room, but it didn't connect to anything. Like, there was no, you know, there was no modem.
Sure.
I didn't have a modem or anything. And I think now when, you know, we're constantly on our computers, or like, you know, even on my way here, I'm like listening to a podcast, I'm checking my phone, you know, and it's sort of like we've become enslaved to the to our screens, really. And, you know, obviously there are good things that come about. I'm not saying technology is all bad, but there's something about like the pace of early internet, and also the fact that it hadn't colonized our minds. There's a, you know, sometimes I think about books like, I might've mentioned this on my first appearance on your show, like The Rings of Saturn, like this W.G. Sable book, intensely elusive. I believe I got it in around 96 or so. And I loved it. And I dove in, and there are all these references and allusions. By the time I was teaching it, several years later, quite a few years later, you know, a lot of students were like, so then I looked it up to see, you know, right. which is a natural response. But for me, the part of the magic of a book like, of a writer like Sebald is just to let yourself be in the presence of a writer who is telling you things. Like, I don't need any other confirmation from the hive mind, right?
Right, and that's part of the point. And I should say, thanks to you, Ed, I read Rings of Saturn. You recommended it, and my friend Joe Magasco also recommended it highly. And so well worth it. And as you say, you read Rings of Saturn. To me, part of the point is you don't want to know what's historical and what's not. You want to just experience going on that walking trip with him. And some of it is probably accurate to the physical reality, and some is just spun as a storyteller spins a tale, and it's woven in. And you did that. I think we talked about this. You did that in Same Bed, Different Dreams.
Sure.
What is history? What? Someone asked. Yeah. And it's, you know, there was Korean history, and there was some pure storytelling that you wove together
as
well. You don't want to have to, just to keep on this point,
of course.
You don't want to have to look up every single thing to say, oh, that's in Wikipedia, that's not.
I think it speaks to a bigger question of who has time to read anymore? You are a champion reader. Like, you read a lot, and I love our conversations about books. I recently finished, Dostoevsky, Brothers Karamazov, which I had never read, and it was such an immersive, I looked forward to, usually it was at night, I looked forward to reading, you know, a couple chapters every night without the phone, without, you know, I don't want to know about his life. I'll look at that stuff later, but I want to be in that world. And I feel like, I mean, this is, readerly attention span is, I guess, collateral damage in terms of what the internet has wrought. And, you know, it's self-serving a little bit because I am a writer. But it's also like, I mean, I don't know how conscious this was, but trying to like keep the flag up for that kind of thinking and that kind of art. The kind that takes time, and you have to invest some time of your own as a participant, as a reader as well.
And I wonder, I mean, here we are, what are we, 30 years after the events in these stories like Machine City, 30-something years, and you're looking back and the reader's looking back with you onto those early days of the internet. If I cast my vision up into the future 30 years, do books even exist? And then does someone write a nostalgic novel about the early 2020s?
Spotify was so great.
Spotify,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, but see, here you're giving a narrative, and the phones all had coiled cords. But in the future, it's going to be quick cut. What was it like walking from the train station to the radio station with three different feeds?
With three different things going on. Yeah, no, it's true. And there are other stories in here that are more of the moment. I'll just mention one of them is called Bring on the Dancing Horses. And that was probably 2010, 2009, 2010. And, you know, this is a Facebook is mentioned in the story, but it's a different era of Facebook. It's like kind of, you know, I don't want to say too much, but it felt, you know, necessary to the story. But now looking back, it's like a time capsule. Like, nobody really uses Facebook that way anymore. So it's interesting how just like different, you know, iterations of technology, in some ways, nothing lasts that long.
That's right.
And, you know, you're going to be looking at it in the rearview mirror eventually.
It's any moment, any slice of internet culture eventually turns into nostalgia.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't last. There's one of the stories, and I don't know if it's Dancing Horses or another one, where one of the characters has a gag on social media where she impersonates a lynx.
That's right. Twitter. Yeah, no,
Is it that story?
It's in Seven Women. Yeah.
Oh, Seven Women.
Exactly.
That's right. And there again, you think, well, first of all, who uses Twitter/X these days? And whatever social media service one chooses to use, nobody's impersonating a lynx. But back 10 years
That's
ago,
right.
I could totally see that.
They did. I mean, that was like a snake escaped from some zoo, and people immediately started
That's right.
doing fake accounts.
What was it? Harambe?
Yes, I think the Cleveland Zoo.
It was a gorilla.
A gorilla.
And then many people were creating fan accounts for Harambe, but that just doesn't really happen.
And this was definitely a pre-X Twitter. And this was, I think you're absolutely right. It was about 10 years ago, 2014 even maybe. And, you know, when I gathered the stories for the collection, you know, partly it was just my favorite stories, the ones I remember most fondly. But, you know, I was going through like a story like that, and I got to that Twitter part. I'm like, do I update it? And I'm like, no, no. I think it's valuable to have to kind of memorialize that that little slice of internet time. It felt like the right thing to do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through the show, and I'm so pleased to have a live in-studio guest, my friend Ed Park, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and award winner of all kinds of other awards he talked about earlier, novelist who's written Personal Days, Same Bed, Different Dreams, and now a short story collection called An Oral History of Atlantis. If you want a link to Ed's site and Ed's book, go to the Tectonic playlist. You can find it at tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. And you just scroll down and find the Ed Park Show, or the most recent one, and click the playlist link, and there it is. Speaking of slices of technology culture that don't last, it's not all nostalgia. There was one story in particular called Eat, Pray, Click that painted a picture of something that I think has not fully happened yet, but I think is going to, inevitably. And in fact, I talked about it last week. I didn't explicitly mention your book. Mm-hmm. I wanted to keep things under wraps a little bit. But what's happening in Eat, Pray, Click, part of what's happening in this story, is that there is a hacker named Rolf who has hacked a Kindle. And this is, of course, totally fictional, and you're setting this a few years ago when the Kindle was a relatively new device, when did you write this story?
That's a great question. I believe I wrote the first version of it, which was quite a bit longer, around 2008-2009.
Oh, that long ago?
Yeah, that long ago. So I didn't even have a Kindle then, and I was fascinated by, you know, people who had one, and I'd be like, oh my God, this is... And I didn't get one for a while, but... You know, immediately as a fiction writer, I was like, what kind of mischief could happen with a device like this?
And so you came up with this really impressive, Ed. You came up with this scenario 2008, 2009, and now in 2025, on last week's show, I talked about something that I think is probably going to be an emerging dystopia. This is around the issue of truth and original sources. Uh-huh. So let me read this. I'm just going to read a couple of short passages from Eat, Pray, Click. And this is the hacker Rolf demonstrating this hacked Kindle that he'd put together. And you write, on it, that is, on the Kindle, were small text files drawn from the works of Raymond Carver and John Irving, Salinger and Vonnegut. Rolf palpated the click wheel, pressed another, this is on a first-generation iPod.
Right.
I should have said.
That's right.
The first-generation iPod kids had this click wheel that you could rotate. So this is the click wheel on the iPod. Rolf palpated the click wheel, pressed another of the long, thin buttons on the edge of the Kindle, and told me to read the page again. It was the scene where Holden's wondering where the Central Park, and I should say this is part of The Catcher in the Rye.
That's
They've
right.
got The Catcher in the Rye
yep.
up. It was a scene where Holden's wondering where the Central Park ducks go in the winter, except now, click, the narrator is drawing a cathedral with a blind man, or spin, click, wrestling with a cross-dressing bear, or spin, click, click, memorializing the firebombing of Dresden, which of course is a Vonnegut reference. So you have this hacker who has played with the text of The Catcher in the Rye, and Rolf, a few paragraphs later, gives his pitch. He says, imagine that the book is changing as you read it, that the next chapter will be altered based on what the Kindle thinks is good for you. Hear me out. The first time you take a break and power down the device, it actually stays awake and gets to work. It contemplates your rate of virtual page turns, the enthusiastic heat from your thumbs. If it senses that you're the kind of person who can't wait and that you intend to read a good chunk of the book right now, it will make certain reasonable assumptions about your reading tastes and then access Update A, which contains subtle changes to the original. A few of the tertiary players may be given bigger speaking roles while some of the main characters futz around in a beach house, away from the action, and so on and so forth. Basically, what you're writing here, Ed, is, like I said, exactly the emerging dystopia that I was warning against, and I showed some initial signs of this coming together, that as tech companies invest more and more in AI, and these AI platforms are drawing together, not to say plagiarizing, but I will say it, plagiarizing works from novelists and journalists and artists, and then putting mushing it all together and putting it together into a form that it thinks will get the most engagement from the user. How long is it before the AI platforms don't simply source from the plagiarized material, but go into the material and change it for the benefit of the corporation, which they'll sell as to the benefit of the user? This is what you're writing about. Yeah. What, 17 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, it. On the one hand, it was an amusing idea. On the other hand, I think a very real anxiety over, you know, the permanency, the fixity of the written word. You know, this story, all the stories were kind of written before kind of the AI we have now in ChatGPT. But I think you're exactly right. This is sort of the road that I think a lot of companies might be going down.
I mean, what happens if pick your big tech company. I mean, there's one in particular that deals in books that we could name, but it could be any of them. It says, now we are happy to present The Catcher in the Rye, but it's updated with AI. It's powered by AI. As you read it, the story will read your reactions and will change the narrative for your benefit, user. And don't you think people will be lining up to try it out?
Yeah, and I could see it with movies, streaming, entertainment as well. It's funny because you remember Choose Your Own Adventures, right?
Of course.
And I think there was a Netflix show that also had
I think it was Bandersnatch.
Yes, from the Black Mirror spinoff,
Black Mirror,
right?
Yes.
And so it's been done, and there's that kind of that format is kind of interesting, but like, what if you put that on steroids and like have it, you know, completely, no author is required in a way, right? You can just have the computer kind of generate these things.
That's totally possible. And if they say this is a choose your own adventure of Catcher in the Rye, you've never read anything like the Holden Caulfield on AI. You've never seen anything like it. I could see that, but I think even more sinister, that's just disappointing and tacky, but what's, I think, sinister is the possibility of these AI platforms to go in and make subtle changes that are there, and here I'm specifically thinking of things like history books and primary sources that erase. I mean, this was part of the concept behind Orwell's 1984, is that we're going into the original sources and we're removing anything that represents wrongthink. It doesn't seem like we're that far from that happening.
Right.
And once the digital source, I'm sorry, I'm going on one of my rants. Once the digital source.
That's why I'm here, man. Right?
Once the digital source has been subtly changed, then the next generation, if they grow up with that as their source, that becomes the source of truth. Rather than someone saying, let me go back to the print version.
I mean, you already see, I can't remember the exact quote, but recently this has surfaced, like, there's a famous Joan Didion quote, I wish I could remember it, but somebody has, or a computer has added, like, a couple lines that sort of, she never wrote, so it's like this, you know, kind of one of her pithy sayings that is now nothing, you know, about one third of it is her, right? I mean, you see this already in like quotation sites and things like that, right?
Right.
Where these are not actually, I don't know if it's maliciously done, but it's just sort of like everything is stupid, and you know they're kind
well,
of
well now it's just
quotes.
Slopified.
Yeah, everything is slop, right?
It's just whatever can get engagement. I mean, there's plenty of examples of that, of whole slew of websites out there that are just full of nothing but AI output, and they're just farming engagement.
Yeah.
None of it means anything at all. So yes, good job, Ed, on pointing out our emerging dystopia 17 years ago. And here we are.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because the story was, a lot of these stories, I should point out, I wrote because there was a reading. Somebody had invited me to do a reading, and that was one of them. But I wrote it in a day, but it was like I was trying to cram every idea I had around, I guess, around Kindles and e-ink and stuff like that. And it wound up just being like way too long for the reading. So then a couple months passed, I was going to read again, and I drastically cut it down. But I think it's much more effective now. There's something about writing with an audience in mind, like somebody is going to listen to you, that actually is a really great editor. So
you know what else is a great editor, Ed? It's ChatGPT.
That well, so just... so I've heard. Yeah.
No, I did want to ask you. You're a real life, flesh and blood novelist, award winning novelist. You've got a new book out, and here we are in 2025, and AI is just, you know, steamrolling everything.
Yeah.
And my opinion that there are some limited uses of this stuff, but for the most part, it's sucking down energy and power and just spreading slop and at best mediocrity everywhere. What does that mean for novelists? Do you talk to other writer colleagues? Do you find people are tempted to dip into ChatGPT to get a little bit of help? With their writing?
I don't find that personally. And to be honest, like among writers who I talk to, writers who are friends, like the topic doesn't really come up. Because I think at the end of the day, if you are the kind of person who wants to do that, you'll do it. I don't think you're a real writer, right? Maybe you'll get away with it. Maybe you won't. But it's not interesting to me. Like it doesn't inform how I'm going to write my books. I am sort of on the outside, I'm curious, but not really that curious. Like I still have the books that I want to write and the stories I want to write. And I don't, you know, I still believe in myself enough to think that, you know, AI is not going to be able to replicate, you know, what it is I do.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Is that naive? But
I admire you, and I wish every writer had your attitude. And I can't wait for your next book that has no AI slop inside of it, unless some platform decides to inject it
to do it
role style. But I wanted to you this. I read this clip, this quote last week on the show, but I want to get your take on this, because in the New York Times, there was a story about Steven Johnson, who's this popular history book writer, also a Google employee, who was selling this notebook LM AI platform as a way that he and other writers could help structure their books by just putting in some ideas. And the journalist Bill Wasik from The Times writes, "When I asked Stacy Schiff, the author of Decorated Biographies of Cleopatra
and Vera
Nabokov, about the notion of consulting AI on how to structure a piece of writing, she replied, 'To turn to AI for structure seems less like a cheat than a deprivation, like enlisting someone to eat your hot fudge sundae for you.'"
I like that. Look, structure is hard. Like, not so much with this book, but with Same Bed, Different Dreams, you know, I had a lot of, it was like a 9-year process, right? And a lot of that's pure writing and, you know, research and stuff, but a lot of it was also structure. And it wouldn't be the book that it is had I not had a lot of kind of agony trying to figure it out. Like, how am I going to fit, you know, essentially, like, there are three different storylines, many different voices. But it's up to me to figure out how that story is going to play out and what information goes where and, you know, how to alternate. It's a very handmade process.
That's right.
And I honestly, I don't see how AI, what would I do? Like, just put my hundreds, you know, even actually 1,000 pages of stuff and say, make a book out of it. Like, it just, it wouldn't be good. And it wouldn't have any kind of internal coherence. Like, I just think that's ridiculous. I think, Stephen Johnson, like, I kind of know who he is. I wonder if there's a certain kind of, like, very functional nonfiction book where people would do that. That's not the kind of book I'm interested in reading, or I'm definitely not writing. I'm definitely not writing that kind of book. Yeah. So, you know, I think we're kind of dealing with very different genres.
That's right. That's fair. Yeah. A while back, I had on the show John Warner, who wrote a book called More Than Words: How to Think About Writing in the Age
John
of AI.
Warner,
Great book and a great interview. And one of the things that he says in the book repeatedly is that writing is hard. Writing is difficult. Writing is painful. And that's just the nature of the process, isn't
it? Yeah. I mean, there's certainly, you know, a couple months ago, there was a thing in the Chicago Tribune where it was slop, right? It was like the best books of the summer.
Yeah.
But half of the, you know, the authors were real, but half of those titles didn't exist. And it was some beleaguered writer, you know, pseudo-journalist saying, I just had too much work and I
Well, they gave the guy an impossible task. They're probably paying him.
Yeah, no, true. I'm not unsympathetic,
yeah.
But it's also like, you should not do that.
Right.
You just should not
just
do,
don't
that.
Do that. Right.
And it, like, that's not, I feel like people can do that, but it's to what end? Like,
right.
It's just, don't be a writer then. Just
that's right.
Go do something else.
Although,
something, I don't know what, AI is taking all the jobs, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure. How do you feel about the future of reading? I mean, the novelists, you and your other novelist friends are still going to be doing excellent work. How do you feel about the market of readers? Does it seem to be shrinking, or do we have a remnant that's holding on tight?
I think books are very popular. I think fiction's, you know, people are always going to read fiction, and they're always going to, you know, tastes change, styles change, but, you know, strong work is going to have it, you know, have an audience. I mean, that's what I think. I could be wrong, but it's also, you know, we're talking about AI, we're talking about all these developments, and I don't know, at a certain point, aren't people going to get, it's a little bit like, you kind of get sick of it. Like, I don't even like thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's just kind of depressing. And
welcome to my show.
Yeah, welcome to, yes. I mean, maybe it's your show that I listen to so much that's putting me in this mindset. But it's also like, is that really how you want to live your life?
Exactly.
Is that really how you want, like, to outsource everything and not, you know, you're a smart, I'm not talking about you,
but the
audience, people in general, like, you have a brain, you know, learning how to write, learning how to structure things, that's important. Like, why not just embrace it? Like,
any sort of independent thought is worth holding on to.
Yeah.
There's this term of sloppers.
Yeah.
That's becoming popular. You've heard it. People who turn to AI for every little decision of their lives. And I heard one, or saw one anecdote. I think this was on Blue Sky or something. Someone said, I was at a restaurant, and at the table next to me, someone said, ChatGPT, what should I order from this restaurant? It's like, you cannot even use your brain to look at the menu and make a choice.
Exactly. I don't know. I'm not saying there aren't some uses
that might be
good, but when it comes to writing, and you know, this is all I've done for the last several decades, right? This is kind of my life. So
there's no
point in me doing AI. I might as well just quit.
What about teaching? You mentioned teaching writing. Do you want to say anything about the experience of teaching in the age of AI?
Well, it's funny because I started teaching really, actually before Personal Days came out. So this was like 2007. and then I taught for a few years, then I didn't teach for a long time. And I just got back to it, like, right as ChatGPT was happening. Like, I think right that first year of 2023, 2024, I think that's correct. Like, suddenly there was something that I don't think anybody really had to think about before. Obviously, there was plagiarism and, you know, cheating and stuff before, but this was kind of like, what the, this beast has suddenly arisen. And, I, you know, my policy was just like, don't use it. like, I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to like feed it into a thing. Your stories, and, you know, I teach creative writing. So, I'm not going to like try to be a cop, you know.
This is 73% chance of being AI generated.
I just find that, like, take a different class. Like, don't be a writer. Like, it's not, right. I'm not even, you know, I'm asking you to write, you know, a couple stories. We have these assignments. We actually, I do have some, like, in-class, like, handwritten stuff. So, obviously, that's not going to be.
Right.
And, on a, you know, I don't think, and once again, maybe I'm being naive. The work that I'm getting, it just seems real. You know, I'm not saying everything's perfect, but it doesn't seem like ChatGPT would generate this. And one thing that I've noticed, it bugs me on the one hand as a former copy editor, but I think it's a generational thing, like placement of punctuation, like commas and quotation marks. Like, a lot of kids, students, I'm teaching college level, like, get it wrong. But I think that might also speak to them not using ChatGPT, because I think if you do use it in AI, the grammar is going to be perfect, right, at the very least. So,
did you read that Hua Su piece in The New Yorker?
I sure did, yeah. Hua's an old friend of mine.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So Hua Su wrote this piece in The New Yorker about talking to New York University students about their use of AI. I thought it was a fascinating story. And one of them at some point said that he or she, I forget, actually will put in some typos. They use AI.
Maybe I'm being taken for a ride.
Yeah. No, I don't mean to suggest your students are doing that, but it is a strategy out there, apparently.
Right. I mean,
you're
told not to do something, but there are ways around it.
And the NYU students that were in the story anyway were using it all the time
for everything, even for the response to his invitation to meet.
Yes.
Right? He asked. I mean, that was pretty. I mean, it was very funny, but it's also like it's kind of sad, right?
It is kind of sad.
Well, I feel like we're of a generation where we've had a life before ChatGPT, obviously, and we've had a life even before the internet, right? We had a life where, you know, you read a physical book.
That's
right. You looked at an encyclopedia. And I guess what makes me a little sad is, you know, we have kids who are around the same age. Like, you know, there was very little time for them to not have, you know, so much tech, like, on their shoulders. And, you know, maybe that's just an old fogey talking, but I think there's something that's lost a little if you can't kind of think outside of what can I look up.
You and me both. I've had this conversation a number of times. I was just somewhere with DJ Paradox, and he's reading a print book, and so I was quietly very happy to see that. But, you know, I'm not gonna say anything. Just let him read. And then I looked over a few minutes later, and he was on his phone. I didn't say anything. You know, whatever. So after a while, he comes over and he says, Dad, I enjoy this book, because I'd recommended it to him.
Yeah.
And I said, that's great. And I said, I noticed you checked your phone. Did something come up? And he says, well, I heard the notification or the vibration or whatever from a bunch of texts coming in.
Okay.
Which meant that my friends were starting a text thread, and I didn't want to leave them hanging. And what that reminded me is that there are now social expectations.
Yeah.
You know, as you write in An Oral History of Atlantis, in the old days, you could send an email and it's
a novelty, right?
It could be weeks before you hear back, and that's okay. But now a text comes in, you get three texts in succession, and you think, I need to put my book down because my friends are expecting me to join in. That's so I'm trying to have some empathy for this generation. Yeah. That's got to be tough.
Well, yeah, there's a whole new set of social cues. Yeah, no, I hear you.
So where do you think we go from here? give us the 10,000 foot view. Are you working on another book? And what is inspiring you to dig into now?
Well, I'm working on another novel. I actually have I wrote a flurry of short stories kind of after this book was put to bed, after An Oral History of Atlantis was all like kind of ready to go. So I have a new set of stories, some of which deal with technology as well. But the bigger work that I'm doing is, if anything, more old fashioned. Like it's kind of paper. You know, the conceit is like, this is a letter by someone. This is like somebody's unpublished, you know, memoir. This is, you know, old correspondence that's been discovered, and almost the idea of like this paper trail. Maybe that's also nostalgia, but we're all kind of, you know, we're online all the time, and there's something about perhaps, you know, as I write a new book and I'm, you know, kind of living in this fantasy of the world of the book, I want to run away from tech. I will say right now, I do have part of the book that I envision as kind of an old school blog, like a blogger type blog with a post, and then I'm sure it's been done before, but like a lot of the narrative coming in the comments section.
Yeah, sure.
But that's like retro at this point,
yeah.
Right?
Blogs and comments.
Blogs and comments, right? But by and large, I think what I'm doing, it's not the same as Same Bed, Different Dreams, but there are some of the same like obsessions, and there's more, you know, I kind of returned to Korea in a lot of ways, Buffalo, Western New York, where I'm from originally, like that kind of feeds into it. But I wanted to have that feel, but you know, I also want people to read it. So I'm, you know, it's always a negotiation with kind of the subject matter and what is the structure? What is the narrative voice doing that's going to appeal to readers?
Well, I'm so happy that that's in progress. And
you've already written
some of the stories already, and I'm really looking forward to reading it.
Thanks.
And the tech is going to be a part of it again. I just want to put in one more plug for another story. We don't have much time, but I just wanted to say, I really enjoyed, and I remember when it originally came out, the story Slide to Unlock.
Yeah.
Such a clever story. This story by itself is worth a price of admission in my opinion. This is a story entirely about passwords and security questions.
That's right.
And that's all I'm going to say. But you got to read the whole thing to understand why. It's very clever and it gets to some of the things we're talking about around nostalgia and a slice of life.
Thank you.
So this is a very tectonic book. It's got a lot to explore. It has a lot of connections and themes outside of technology, but tech itself does play a starring role once again. And the book is called An Oral History of Atlantis. It's out now, and it's written by my live in studio guest and my friend, Ed Park. Ed, thank you so much for being on the show, and I can't wait for you to be back on sometime.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
And again, if you want links to Ed's site, Ed's book, and the whatever other information you're interested in, you can find it on the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm, and you can find the information about An Oral History of Atlantis if you click the playlist link for the Ed Park episode. My own email is mark@wfmu.org. That's mark@wfmu.org. You can send me your thoughts and comments, just like the old days when people would send emails to each other. And you are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM and online at wfmu.org. I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who you can't handle, with his show, It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show, and I know you're going to enjoy it. Until next time, friends, I have some homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And in honor of Ed Park and his great book, An Oral History of Atlantis, I thought for our closing tune tonight, we'd hear a little song by Donovan called Atlantis. Have a great week, everybody.
The continent of Atlantis was an island which lay before the Great Flood in the area we now call the Atlantic Ocean. So great an area of land that from her western shores those beautiful sailors journeyed to the south and the North Americas with ease in their ships with painted sails. To the east, Africa was her neighbor, across a short strait of sea miles. The great Egyptian age is but a remnant of the Atlantean culture. The antediluvian kings colonized the world. All the gods who play in the mythological dramas, in all legends from all lands, were from fair Atlantis. Knowing her fate, Atlantis sent out ships to all corners of the earth. On board were the 12. The poet, the physician, the farmer, the scientist, the magician, and the other so-called gods of our legends, though gods they were. And as the elders of our time choose to remain blind, let us rejoice and let us sing and dance and ring in the new. Hail Atlantis!
And that lovely sound means you are now in touch in communication with It's Complicated, my radio show. I'm Dave Mandel. This show is called It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm here every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Thank you for tuning in, joining me this week. On tonight's show, I have a very special interview with Sid Smith, who is a UK-based writer/journalist, an expert, although you'll hear him modestly deny that in the interview, an expert on Prague. And I will, just to accommodate the latecomers, I'll play a piece of music first. I won't dive right into the interview. We're going to hear a track from a German band called Contrast. Where is it? It was here a minute ago. We're going to hear something from an album called Volume 1 that was released in 1986 and reissued on the label that I mentioned last week, Cosmic Egg, the German prog label. They released it, re-released it in 2018 or so, but this is from the mid-80s Contrast, and I'll be back after this and with that interview.
Ah. He hanged himself in Portside on the only tree in the park. Around the corner, lassie trouble, I heard. But he was a lovely man who could speak riddles in rhyme. You try it.